Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, August 8, 2024. IDPs in Upper Nile State say they need services. And authorities in Upper Nile State say Sudan government continues to pound villages in Mabaun County. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. IDPs in Malakal say they are facing challenges in a new camp established by the UN authorities. Some of the IDPs say they lack services like water, clean sanitation and nutrition. For VOA News, Mamer Abraham Kwot reports from Malakal.
Thousands of internally displaced persons or IDPs in Malakal town say they need help. 35-year-old Nyanbol Them, a mother of five children, says most of the families in the IDP camp inside Malakal town face many challenges.
Rain falls on us and we are bitten by mosquitoes. We are living in a school and there is open defecation. Flies cause diarrhea and vomiting. Mosquitoes are also a challenge, as you see. We do not have mosquito nets and we don't have house. Mosquito bites and lack of food are affecting the elderly. If there are aid organizations, they should help us.
Them says some women collect firewood for sale in order to feed their families. 35-year-old Nyan Nyogdul, a mother of three, says her children are missing classes in the camp.
Children were studying in the camp we came from. Even when we left, They were registered, but now some children are in school and other children are not in school. We pay money for a child to be registered. If there is no money, a child remains at home.
The first deputy speaker of the Transitional National Legislative Assembly, Nathaniel Oyet-Pierino, said Wednesday that the August House has summoned 10 national ministers to appear in Parliament on Wednesday next week to answer questions related to hunger across the country. Zakaria Yarlul, chairperson of the IDP camp, says medical workers allegedly asked them to carry 6 persons to the hospitals.
We do not have any property. We do not have food. We do not have land. And we do not have shelters. Can't we be assisted? We should be helped so that if these children survive, they may be the future of this country. And the elderly should not die of hunger, yet South Sudan has become an independent nation. The government has not come back to us, and no aid agency is responsible for us. We are neglected.
VOA could not independently verify Lul's accounts of the situation of IDPs in Malakal. Peter Pal, acting chairperson of South Sudan's Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Upper Nile State, says he will send a team to assess the camp. For VOA News, I am Amira Bramcourt, reporting from Malakal, Upper Nile State.
From Upper Nile State, we move to Western Equatoria State, where authorities say they are dealing with a high number of rape cases this year, and many of the victims are underage girls. For VOA News, Matia Samuel Timatio reports from the state capital, Yambio.
James Lino is a gender-based violence caseworker at Yambio State Hospital. He says his office registered 119 cases of underage girls and 11 cases of women who say they were raped at gunpoint so far this year.
In this year of 2024, we got about 130 GBV survivors of rape abuse, especially things to do with rape, of which we have got 11 mature women who have gone through GBV abuse. This year is leading in rape cases. When we say rape cases, we do mean by all the underage. We have got a huge number actually that I wonder of compared to the last year's statistic.
He says culture of impunity has emboldened perpetrators of gender-based violence, so men continue abusing women and girls in Yambio. Under South Sudan law, a person who has sexual intercourse with another person against his or her will can be convicted of rape and jailed for up to 14 years. A 14-year-old survivor, who shall identify her Cecilia to protect her privacy, says she was raped in May.
My father one day went to visit my elder brother and left us in the house with my siblings. At night, a young man came to our house and broke our door when we were sleeping inside. He came with two of his friends. They were standing by the door. He had a knife in his hand which he wanted to stab me with. I asked him what he wanted, but he only said he came to see me. Then he grabbed me by force and slept with me. My siblings started shouting and they grabbed the knife from him. Then he and his friends ran away. Our neighbors came and I called my father the same time to inform him. Case has been already opened against the perpetrator, but I don't know his whereabouts.
Mbarago, she says she was raped by a man her parents knew.
One day we were just seated in the house around 7 p.m. Some young men just came to our house. One of them was a police working in one of the customs here in Yambio. I knew them before because they used to come to our house. When they came, I greeted them. Immediately after the greeting, I don't know what happened to me. I only found myself in his house. I started feeling something in my private, and he told me he wanted us to travel to Juba. When my father heard about the issue, he went and opened case against the man Japan and was later arrested and taken to police station.
Amjuma Elizabeth is the gender-based violence clinical officer at Yambio State Hospital. She says rape victims get medical assistance and are treated to prevent possible diseases at the hospital.
If the person who raped is having other viral diseases like hepatitis, HIV, the person will not be entitled to acquire those diseases. It affects most of our girls because, you know, they are not prepared for it. Rape is something someone is not prepared for.
Kenneth Mohandes Manga is Director General of the Western Equatoria State Ministry of Gender, Child and Social Welfare. He says the ministry and its partners are working to develop additional laws for dealing with rape.
What we are lacking at the state, like for instance, we don't have the law which can guide a bit some issues. That's why now the ministry come up together and the partners, they try to develop the bylaw.
Major General Hussein Girisi is the Chief Inspector of Police in Yambio.
With the police, we are working day and night to solve the case. We are not the people who are supposed to stop it, the rape cases. We need the parents to participate, to take care of their children. Let them know where the girl is going. It will make the cases be limited. Don't let them go to disco. Don't let them go from the house over 10 o'clock. Something like that. So this will help us.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan reports conflict-related sexual violence surged in some parts of Western Equatorial State because of ethnic-related fighting in the area. For VOA News, I am Matthias Samuel Timatio, reporting from Yambio, Western Equatorial State.
From Yambio, we move to Juba, where the South Sudan's men's basketball team, the Bright Star, received a heroic welcome upon arrival at Juba International Airport on Thursday after they were eliminated last week by Serbia in the Olympic Games. Dennis Logonyi reports for VOA from the capital, Juba.
Rebecca Nyandeng, Vice President for Gender and Youth Cluster, and other dignitaries greeted the team at Juba International Airport. Thousands of South Sudanese that arrived at the airport to show their appreciation for their country's team joined the Bright Star on a roadshow around Juba streets. There was applause and ululation as the men's basketball team waved to fans around the capital. William Madok, a diehard fan of the Bright Star, says he was thrilled to meet some of the players.
I am proudly here to say that I can shout the maximum I can shout as a welcoming. And with this, we want to tell the world that we are coming.
Ajang Madut, the chief from Northern Baragazel State, made his way to Juba so that he could receive the team. He says the Olympic basketball team has made South Sudan proud.
We are here to receive our basketball team players who went and made a great work from Paris Olympic. So we are so happy for the great achievement what they have done. They have made our country proud. And we are so proud of them.
Another South Sudanese who only identified herself as Naomi used her poetic talents to entertain fans who came to welcome the Bright Star.
In my arms are the Bright Stars, wearing their crown of their ancestors. I am the Bright Star. I am the 64 tribe. The beauty of the nation flag. I am the Bright Star. I am the 64 tribe. I am a South Sudanese. I am a proud mother of Bright Stars. I am a proud mother of 64 tribe. I am the conqueror of the Bright Stars. I am the conqueror of the Nile. I am the conqueror of the Bright Star. I am a Bright Star. I am a 64 tribe.
Kwany Kwany, captain of the basketball team, thanked fans for encouraging players during the games in Paris.
I mean, the whole world now knows who South Sudan is. And, you know, through basketball, the best thing for us players was, you know, watching the videos, watching everybody here celebrate, just watching, you know, all our countries come together. You know, it was really a uniting factor. And I think one of the biggest moments where I saw all our South Sudanese unite is when Paul Pierce, you know, said something on the internet. And the whole community went after him, you know, until he had to apologize. And if that's not a unifying factor, I really don't know what that is. So kudos to all of you.
Noni Omot, another Bright Star player who scored points in Paris, says South Sudanese will do more than what they have done this year.
Everybody that's, you know, been a part of this journey, this is just the beginning. You know, this is the start of something that's going to be very special. And it's going to be a team that, you know, people are going to have to really be worried about, you know, and You know, we did that, you know, so you guys have a lot to be proud of. You know, this is just the beginning, like I said before, and I can't express my gratitude enough. So I appreciate you guys so much.
The men's team arrived midday at Juba International Airport, aboard Ethiopian Airlines, and toured the city before wrapping up the day with a party at the basketball stadium in Juba. South Sudan was knocked out of the Olympics game by Serbia. The Bright Star only defeated Puerto Rico in their Group C qualifying games. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logoni reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we go to New York, where a Sudanese activist who addressed the United Nations Security Council Wednesday says the situation for the people of Sudan is desperate. Khaled Kher told the council there are 18,000 people died since the outbreak of conflict in Sudan. She said 25 million people are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance, with 10.7 million internally displaced and over half of the population facing acute hunger. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, youngsters in Nairobi are not giving up on their protest. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. As Kenya's new cabinet gathered to be sworn in today, thousands of mostly young protesters demonstrated in Nairobi. A short time ago, my colleague Muhammad Yahya Swihub spoke with Muhammad Yusuf in Nairobi to update us on the latest demonstrations, dubbed Nane Nani, or 8-8 in Swahili, to signify the day's date.
Yeah, today there were two events. Today, Thursday, there were two events in Nairobi. One at State House, where cabinet members were being sworn in. But a few kilometers away from where the swearing in was taking place, there were planned protests in central Nairobi. Many youths came out to protest against President Ruto government, who they say that he's not doing enough. Of course, there were heavy police presence in central Nairobi. The protesters coming, emerging from several streets, but they were being tear gassed to contain them. Several, it's been generally running battles between the protesters and the youth in central Nairobi, even though many were celebrating that Kenya now has a new cabinet, which they hope will change things and move the country forward.
And Mohammed, Kenya's acting police chief Gilbert Masengele has warned yesterday that criminals intended to infiltrate the demonstrations and advised people to stay away from protected zones such as the main international airport and Ruto's official residence and take precaution in crowded areas. How was the crowd, and did they heed this message from the police chief?
They did. Nairobi, central Nairobi, where most of the protests were being planned, it was quiet. There were no people in the streets except protesters. Many shops were closed, and they heeded to that call. And that has been the image that is being replicated since protests began in June. Many people were very afraid to come out to their businesses, even to come to the streets in Nairobi, because they were fearing that some of these protests might turn deadly violent. And we have seen around June there were some shops that were looted. And all this sort of image that is around protest in Kenya, generally in Kenya, people tend to stay away, and many have stayed away. But generally, of course, many youths have come out to show their displeasure with the Kenyan government led by President William Ruto. There haven't been much events today. It's remained quiet. We haven't seen where we were. We just saw police and youth engaging and running battles here and there. Tear gas. We haven't seen anyone breaking into people's businesses or youth attacking each other, or there were pickpockets, only those sort of things. Even though early in the morning there were those kind of incidents. But generally, it has remained peaceful. There were no water cannons, only tear gas. That shows that the situation was today under control, and and it quite remained peaceful today.
And Mohamed, in a bid to tackle the worst crisis of his presidency, Ruto, like you just said, has taken serious measures to address public anger, including scrapping the tax hikes, reshuffling his cabinet, and making deep budget cuts. What do the protesters want? Do they want his removal, or are these measures enough for them to actually work with Ruto?
The issue here between the protesters, the youth, the public and the government, is, first of all, is the issue of trust. Even though this, the government has made changes that everyone is able to see, like the tax on tax, on dissolving cabinet, but people, in a way, they feel that this government is not up to task to deliver and to work for them. But the government is saying, give us time. We have a new cabinet that we believe it's inclusive and it will solve much of the problem. I think today was a swearing in. Let them go to work, start working, and then we see what they will come up with. And that's the only way we will know if the government is also serious about working for the people and addressing some of their demands.
That was reporter Muhammad Yusuf speaking with my colleague Yahya Swihil from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Now that both the Democratic and Republican presidential candidates have selected their running mates, they question whether those picks will actually help boost the campaign's chances of winning the November election. VOA's Veronica Beldras Iglesias looks at the historical relevance of vice presidential candidates and what Tim Walz and DJ Vance bring to their respective tickets.
With great confidence in her decision, Vice President Kamala Harris introduced Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate on Tuesday in Pennsylvania.
In his state, he has been a model chief executive, and with his experience, I'm telling you, Tim Walz will be ready on day one.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump also hails the political record of his running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. But the former president recently downplayed the importance of vice presidential picks.
And I think this is well documented. Historically, the vice president, in terms of the election, does not have any impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, virtually no impact. And it's all about the presidential pick.
Scholars explain that because vice presidents operate in the shadow of the U.S. president, their role is often misunderstood and unappreciated. They are, however, the first in line of succession when a president can no longer serve, and key to advancing their party's political agenda. Vice presidential scholar Joe Goldstein via Skype.
Their role is really to act as a subordinate, to help promote and pursue the president's policies and to expand the president's ability to function as a national and international leader.
To a certain extent, VP picks can boost presidential campaigns, Goldstein says.
Bill Clinton's pick of Al Gore in 1992 was a very good pick. The combination of these two young Southern centrist baby boomers really sent a message of generational change.
A bad pick is how the analyst described Republican Senator John McCain's decision to have Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate in 2008.
And she really became a figure who was parodied during the campaign and I think ended up hurting the McCain ticket. It wasn't the reason that Senator McCain lost.
This election cycle, Tim Walz's credentials and his focus on pro-family economics is what the Harris campaign is betting on. Elizabeth Clemens is a political sociologist at the University of Chicago. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
A version of being pro-family that is not about the control of reproduction, but is about the economic support of families, be that education, healthcare, housing, job development.
J.D. Vance will help advance the Republican narrative, says analyst Peter Loach. Loach is director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. He spoke via Zoom.
The narrative they're telling
that is, you know, there used to be an America in which if you worked hard and played by the rules, middle class, hardworking family, you could succeed, and that America is now gone. And that if you vote for them, that America will come back.
Even if vice presidential candidates rarely make a major difference in elections, analysts say U.S. voters will pay attention to how well the current VP picks listen to the electorate and channel their concerns. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Still in Washington, the Democratic vice presidential nominee Tim Walz's ties to China will likely inform his work if he's elected. Where does he stand on key issues and how does Beijing see him? Everyone has an opinion. VOA's Anita Powell and Paris Hong, reporter from Washington.
Tim Walz brings deep and broad China experience to Vice President Kamala Harris's presidential campaign, a fact his opponents quickly seized upon. Within hours of Tuesday's announcement, and twice on the same day, his competitor for the vice presidency painted him as soft on Beijing. J.D. Vance is a Republican vice presidential nominee.
She selected Tim Walz, a guy who wants to ship more manufacturing jobs to China. This is a guy who's proposed shipping more manufacturing jobs to China.
In reality, the Minnesota governor's links to the global superpower are deeper, broader, more nuanced, and personal. He made no mention of China at his debut campaign appearance. But here is the then congressman in 2016 on living in and visiting China about 30 times.
I don't fall into the category that China necessarily needs to be an adversarial relationship. I totally disagree, and I think we need to stand firm on what they're doing in the South China Sea. But there's many areas of cooperation that we can work on.
And with VOA in 2014, he described what it was like to live there during the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests.
It was an amazing thing to watch as the goddess of democracy rose, and it was very powerful. And I'm certainly honored to have been there and to see the spirit of the Chinese people about trying to, very proud of their country, but understanding that freedom needs to shine.
In the hours after his debut on the campaign trail, Harris's vice presidential pick and his travels in China quickly became a trending topic. This user said, "I think he might be friendly to China." While in Congress, Walz co-sponsored a number of resolutions critical of China's human rights record. One nationalist military historian said the Democrats want to destroy China. And on Walz's life-changing lunch with the Dalai Lama, Tibet's exiled leader, one user said the former teacher in China looks like a spy. Keen China watchers say that so far, Beijing has not publicly reacted. But here's what they see in Walz. Kaiser Guo is host of the Seneca podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China.
He's been very forthright in his criticisms of China's human rights record. And I think he's done that from a position that is maybe more credible. It's because of his kind of conspicuous earnestness and his sincerity and the embodiment of the kind of, you know, values that he purports to be wanting to spread to China.
Other China analysts echoed Guo's thought that Walz, if elected, is unlikely to change the steady drumbeat of diplomacy. Jim Fallows covered China as a journalist, has written two books on the country, and was a speechwriter for former President Jimmy Carter.
If he should win and he becomes vice president under Kamala Harris, a President Kamala Harris, I think this should be seen around the world, in China, in Asia, as continuity in the complex decades-long U.S. policy of recognizing the need to deal with China as a major power in that, the world, and that part of the world, but also the differences in values, especially when it comes to democratization.
But what does Beijing think? That's harder to guess.
I would imagine they're essentially gobsmacked at the moment of not knowing what to make of this person who's not who they expected.
So as this duo, both born in 1964 under the same lunar zodiac sign, barnstorms America, Beijing can only wonder, what would the future hold with a pair of wood dragons in the White House? Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Stop à la guerre. That's all we prepared for you this Thursday, August 8, 2024. We now leave you with Fally Ipupa and the song Stop a la Guerre. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Oh, na na.